Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Randall Keenan. I'm excited about today's interview because in some cases I think I'm going to be introducing you to a voice and a storyteller that it might be a new name for you. And one of the goals of our show is to introduce you to not new writers, but authors who have a body of work which is deserving of a wide audience. And Mr. Keenan fits that mold. And let me tell you how I discovered Mr. Keenan's work. I picked up a copy of his collection of stories, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, which was published in 1992. And one always has the feeling when you open a new book, you don't know what it holds in store for you. You don't know if it's going to be amusing, entertaining, one that you get 50 pages into and run out of steam. But I will tell you that when I read the first two pages of Clarence and the Dead, which is the first story in Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, I was hooked. So first of all, welcome Randall to the show, and it's a delight to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We're at the Suwannee Writers Conference at the University of the South. It's a gorgeous facility and a wonderful conference. And how many years have you been coming to Suwannee now?
This is my third year.
The third year. Mm-hmm. And during the year, you teach. And if you would just tell us a little bit about your background and the things that you did prior to the publication of Let the Dead Bury Their Dead.
I was an editor. I was on the editorial staff of Alfred A. Knopf in New York, and I worked there for about 5 years. And when my first novel came out in 89, I started teaching, and I've been teaching ever since.
Wonderful. Let's get right into it. And if you would, read us the opening of Clarence and the Dead, so the listeners will understand what I'm talking about.
I'd be happy to. Clarence and the Dead. On the day Clarence Pickett died, Wilma Jones's hog Francis stopped talking. Now, of course, no one else had ever heard the swine utter word the first, but Wilma swore up and down that the creature had first said to her, "Jesus wept," on a sunny day in June. But the peculiar thing was that Wilma had not known of Clarence's death when she declared the hog's final hushing up. And oddly enough, it was on the exact day of Clarence's birth, 5 years before, that Wilma had commenced preaching that the hog could talk. They say that day the sun shone when the rain poured. The old folks say that's when the devil beats his wife. The day Estelle Pickett died, giving birth to Clarence. Her mama was out in the cucumber patch when Estelle went into labor, and we came to get her. Miss Eunice, not being an excitable woman, asked if the midwife had been sent for. And when we said yeah, she insisted on topping off her bushel before heading home. Estelle's papa, Mr. George Edward, was away in Wilmington that day looking for a new tractor, since he was sick and tired of his old farmall breaking down every other row and needing more oil than gasoline. We never knew if Miss Eunice blamed herself, cause she never admitted to it, one, and two, we never saw much sign that she did. We all arrived at the picket place at the same time as the midwife. We walked in on one of the most hideous sights we can remember seeing or hearing tell of. There lay Estelle on the bed, her legs apart, her eyes rolled back in her head, her body kind of twisted to the side in a pool so deep red it could have been a maroon sheet she was sitting on instead of white. And on the floor, squalling like a stuck pig was Clarence, a twitching, pitiful little thing in a soup of blood and purple mess and poop. There weren't no call to worry about being over his face as people came to gossip. Just not so. The call seemed to be everywhere else, though. On his head, on his hands, on his belly like a raw liver, quivery and oozy, him caked in a mucky white paste like snot, a nasty enough mess to make you lose your breakfast. Miss Eunice went to fix him up straight away, and the midwife looked to Estelle. "She's gone, child, poor thing," she said.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
That is the beginning of a rollicking story that's very satisfying in its prose, in its structure, and in its comic genius, I think. And when I looked at the cover of Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, I saw there was a quote from Terry McMillan who says, "Randall Keenan is a genius, our Black Marquez. He weaves myth, folk tales, magic, and reality like no one else I know and doesn't miss a beat." That's pretty high praise.
Yeah. It's shocking.
What was your reaction when you started getting some recognition and reviews or praise from a writer like Terry McMillan to be called a Black Marquez? That's
stunning. I didn't expect it. I mean, I was prepared to go on in obscurity for quite some time, and sometimes I think I still am. But it was gratifying. It was weary making, but it gives you a sense that you're doing something.
Yeah,
some of the notes might not be flat.
And as I read some of the stories in Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, I actually did think of Marquez a few times as I was reading it. If you would tell us a little bit about the little town where the stories take place, in which you've kind of claimed as your own now.
Tim's Creek. It's a small town in a real farm community in southeastern North Carolina, not unlike the place where I grew up, down on the coast in the swamps. And this collection sort of swirls around the main novella, which is Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, which traces the origins of the town as a maroon society. Sort of during slavery, slaves would run off and start communities out in the swamps and woods and whatnot. And some of those places have been documented to have survived and to have grown into towns. And so I fancifully allowed Tim's Creek to have its origins going that far back.
Okay.
And so strange things still go on in the town.
Okay. And I'm assuming that the place you grew up in, I can tell that your stories are suffused with a lot of storytelling going on and a lot of passing of stories on from generation to generation. It kind of appears to me in when I read you that there's an oral history in your family, it seems to me, that you've latched on to, because your stories have their, in some cases, have their genesis and their beginnings in a faraway place and in a faraway time.
But yeah. Well, it always comes back to that. It always comes back to stories you've been told. And I'm also interested in one of the things that comes up in the book over and over again are the competing histories, the difference. I mean, even in that title of novella, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, you have several voices going at the same time. You have this old gentleman telling this fantastic story of the origin of the town, and you have his contemporary, this older woman, who's sort of editing it as he goes along and challenging it. So it's a sort of a dialogue between these two. So you get two versions there. And then I'm fascinated with all those standard histories in which people like me were marginal or footnotes, and that fascinates me too. And so you get those stories are woven in there too. So, I mean, to be sure, I initially got interested in the idea of history with a small H and with a capital H by just listening to my great-great aunts. Mm-hmm. You know, these people, when I was a little boy, they were already in their 70s and 80s and 90s, and they would tell these stories. And mm-hmm. so now it's really extraordinary to think, you know, in the 70s, I was, you know, talking to, you know, literally touching someone out of the 19th century, mm-hmm. whose memory stretched back that far. And then they, in turn, you know, sort of did the same with people, you know, who were slaves and mm-hmm. beyond. So, and that's a powerful physical
connection. It is. And it's something that that I was very close with my grandmother as well. And she lived, thank God, to be 95. And I miss her stories. I miss her view of the world.
Right.
And it the history as she knew it is different than history as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And in your case, much different. And that leads to the book walking on water, which I want to spend some time on. It really is kind of an epic type of a work, I think, an opus. And before we start talking about that, when I was doing some reading, you had a background in science.
Right.
And I don't think I've talked to too many writers who began their studies and their careers with a fascination with science and then became writers.
Well, it's probably more common than you realize.
Really?
Most of them might have the good sense not to talk about it like But yeah, it made perfect sense to me because, you know, sentences and equations are a lot alike. And the rules of language and math aren't that far apart. I mean, when you start thinking about it in terms of symbols and signs mm-hmm. and what you do. And also the same satisfaction of manipulating, mm-hmm. you know, squiggles on a page. I mean, mm-hmm. they aren't that different.
Yeah, I can see that that similarity. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we return, we're going to be talking about Walking on Water, Randall Keenan's book, which is a story of Black American lives at the turn of the 21st century, and is a real treat and delight to read. So we'll be right back with Randall Keenan. Welcome back to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted today to have as our guest Randall Keenan. And we're going to talk about a book which, as I've read the book, I have a feeling this started out as a project for Mr. Keenan and then turned into an obsession, and at some point along the way completely got totally out of control. And he had to get the cow back in the barn. So tell us a little bit about this amazing book, Walking on Water.
Well, thank you for thinking it's amazing. Yeah, that's pretty much how it happened. That's something I thought I could do in 2 or 3 years, and it turned into 6 or 7. I wanted to approach the way we Americans think about race, particularly African-American identity, in a way that I had not seen done before, which was through the prism of geography. Because we seem to have a very limited idea about the connection between Black identity and geography. We think there's Black folk in the North who live in urban slums or whatnot, Black folk who live in the South on farms, and which is, first of all, not as accurate as we would like to think, but there's a large country out there. And it becomes really challenging when you think about Black folk who have lived in places we don't think about there being an African-American presence for, you know, over a century. I mean, sometimes in some places 200 years. So I wanted to go to places where there was a documented African-American presence going back to the beginning of the Republic and talk to them. And my main thing was, what does it mean to be Black? To take it to those people, to understand their experience, and you know, what it was like growing up in places like Alaska, in Utah, Louisiana, mm-hmm. and to try to use that to come to some new understanding of.
In the introduction, you talk about living in New York City, and the struggles you went through. You talk about some people and even family members that you should live in Harlem or might live in Harlem, and you had the experience of defining yourself within the metropolis of Manhattan, and it seems like that maybe was the genesis that turned into this desire to hit the road and discover these things, because I think one of the phrases you use in the introduction is, are you Black enough?
Yeah.
And that was very interesting as I read that, to see that side of the Black story in the 21st century. And that, when did you decide to hit the road?
Gosh, I pretty much had been dwelling on it for a number of years before I actually set out, which was in 1991. This thing could turn into an odyssey. I didn't mean for it to, but it did. But yeah, I think that we all, and I think that this is a metaphor for all Americans, or, you know, this is a very American story, that Du Bois calls it when the veil is lifted.
Yes.
You know, when we start seeing ourselves within the context of our identity. I think it happens for, you know, for Jewish Americans, it happens for Italian Americans and Irish Americans. There's some point in which you start seeing yourself. And for me, because I've grown up in, you know, country boy in the South, going to New York, a lot of the assumptions I had made about my identity were challenged because, boy, you know, there's this huge African-American diaspora in New York, you know, just in New York alone, black folk from Haiti and from, the, you know, other parts of the Caribbean and Africa, black people from all over the country. So all these assumptions I had about where I come from and what I was as being, well, the only way, well, that didn't pass muster for very long. And so it got me to thinking really seriously about, well, what are we talking about when we talk about this? How much of this is common? How much of this is old-fashioned? You know, sort of went out with the Civil Rights Acts. You know, and I think, again, I was questing to find out a lot of these things because, you know, I knew what I read in the papers, but I didn't know if any of those things held water anymore.
Mm-hmm. So off you went. And the book is arranged in a geographical fashion, and Mr. Keenan would actually go to the cities that are listed in the table of contents, spend time there, and try to find the origins and some of the history of the black communities that he visited and how they fit within the framework of the city. And some of the cities you'll be familiar with, some less familiar with, and we're going to talk about a couple of the different cities. And as we were talking before we started the show, I had to laugh when I read Bangor, Maine, because I saw that You Think Stephen King.
Right.
You know, so.
Which is one of the reasons I went there, because I'm a huge fan of Stephen King.
And so am I. And Stephen King, if you're listening, please send me an email. I'd love to have you on our show. But Bangor, Maine is, I love the description of the city that you give, and one of the joys of reading it is kind of a like a geographer's or a portrait painting of the area that you're talking about. And then as you begin to meet the people and do your research, the stories unfold. But you've got to tell me the story of when you went to Bangor, Maine, and looked up the NAACP.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of the towns I went to, I had contacts before I went.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I went into Cole, because I just sat down with a map and I said, And as I said, I wanted to see, cause, you know, there weren't that many black folk in Stephen King's books, and yet, you know, I look at the demography maps, and they were, you know, they were those little purple dots. I knew there were black people there, so. What does one do? Well, you call up the local NAACP. Of course you do.
Sure.
To find out where black folk are. So I called up this gentleman. He was very, Mr. Gillespie, I think his name was. I explained what I was doing, and he was very, oh, come on over. So I go over, I open the, you know, I knock on the door opens, and this very handsome, older, white gentleman, silver hair, he invites me in, we sit down, we have a conversation, I left, and I never knew if he thought that I thought he was going to be black or not. It was never mentioned that my expectations were that. He was very helpful, but, I mean, I write about how surprised I was that the NAACP in Bangor, Maine was a white fellow.
That was priceless. We were talking the other night out on the patio here at Rebel's Rest, and the topic of Utah came up, and I was interested in your observations of Utah and your experience when you went out to the state of Utah and Salt Lake City. And what were your perceptions? What did you find out when you went to Utah, the experience?
Well, as I said, so many of you think, I mean, this was, you know, this was my PhD. So many things I had no idea of. Again, I just got these demographic maps and I saw these little purple dots which represented African Americans, and they're literally all over the place. And there were these purple dots in Utah. And I'm thinking, well, you know, there's people who come Johnny Come Latelys, you know. Since.
Right.
But I discover that there is a history of African Americans, not only in Utah, but with the Church of Latter-day Saints, going back to the beginning. And in fact, when Brigham Young sent out pilgrims to find Zion, he sent three black slaves. And so one of the first people, first non-Indians to settle Salt Lake City, among them were black folk. And there is it's not a huge wing, but a strong wing of the LDS church that is constituted by African Americans. And this was before the late 70s, when blacks were deemed okay to become mm-hmm. members of the Mormon church. Mm-hmm. So this was a fascinating, I mean, I shouldn't say discovery because they were already there, but for me, revelation.
Yeah, I was surprised about that.
Which isn't talked about a great deal. And actually the members of the church themselves wouldn't talk to me, but some of their family members did. Mm-hmm. People who had left the church. And I came away with this a new respect for Mormonism. Mm-hmm. As it were, for its industry, for the way it takes care of people materially, and for that just sort of bedrock American enterprise, which is almost frightening in its.
Yeah, we were talking about that the other night. The financial clout.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
And when you were in Utah, for example, what was the length of your stay? What was like the shortest one you did, and what was the longest one you did?
I think I stayed in Salt Lake City 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yeah, maybe a little under. And that was, I think, the longest. It was a little over 2 weeks. And the shortest were a matter of days. A day or two. I went to Saskatchewan. Which was a similar, I'm going to write about that. I went to, there's a football player named Ruben Mays, who I'd read in Sports Illustrated, who was from this itty-bitty town in Saskatchewan, Canada. And his family, they'd moved there from Arkansas at the turn of the century. And, you know, black folk out in the prairies of Saskatchewan, oh, goody, goody. So I get in my little truck, and I go all the way up the prairies of Saskatchewan, and I get to this town, it's called Maidstone. And I skip there, and I spend the night, and I get up in the morning, and I haven't seen any black people. So, not unlike Bangor, I go to the little, I mean, we're talking itty-bitty little library. And I walk in, and I announce myself to this nice little librarian. And I say, excuse me, ma'am, but I'm looking for black people. And she was so crestfallen. Her hands went up to her face, and said, I'm so, so sorry, but all our Negroes moved away years ago. But they had been there, and she called up these ranchers, and they took me to the church. The church is still there, and the graveyard, and they gave me the name of how to find Reuben's father, who lived past the town, North Battleford. And I went back and talked to him, and went to church with him, and hung out. But that was only a matter of a day or two.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a wonderful image.
Yeah. But yeah, I was full of little things like that throughout my trip travels.
Let's talk about another city. Pick one of the cities that for a person, a reader who has not read Walking on Water by Randall Keenan, what's a book, one of the stories that you're particularly fond of that somebody could pick the book up, read the introduction, which is going to whet their appetite, and then, because it seems to me that the stories don't have to be read chronologically necessarily.
No.
So what are kind of the ones that are most memorable for you?
Boy, well, no, I think most people pick it up, and I think it's perfect design that you could read it that way, mm-hmm. by places they are, either where they live or what they're interested in, you know, places they're interested in. I mean, I feel particularly connected of all places to Alaska. Because that was the most far-flung. And people look at you askance. You know, black people in Alaska.
Yeah.
But there were black people in Alaska from the very beginning. I don't know if people know that the most famous, one of the most famous characters of Jack London, Seawolf, that was based on an actual character who was actually a black man from Maine. His family was originally from Maine.
There's something that I don't think too many people knew.
Yeah. But I hung out with his family, a black family who'd been there for four generations. And I really the mother, the grandmother ran a beauty parlor, and there was two young, her grandchildren were just extraordinary. And I connected with the son in an unexpected way, because my father had been in prison, his father was in prison. So while we were talking, we just got on into these really odd things, and who knew?
Mm-hmm.
In Anchorage, Alaska,
mm-hmm.
where the population is actually, you know, commensurate with the percentage, 13-14%.
That's interesting.
The nation. The thing was in Utah. There's a black senator, Senator Elizabeth Harriet Byrd, fifth generation Wyoming, and she gave me one of the most moving interviews. Ellensworth, California. Some people in California might know it, but it's the only town in California that was founded by and for black folk.
Hmm.
The highest ranking military official during the Civil War, that was a chaplain, Allen Ellensworth, came out to California into the San Joaquin Valley, and his goal was to found a Tuskegee West. And he got off to a pretty good start, but as people know, that is one of the most fertile farm lands in the world, not the country, but the world, and the farmers didn't like that, and so they, you know, conspired to get rid of them. And about 30 years later, after the community was destroyed, this one man single-handedly brought back Ellensworth as a state park, and I got to talk to Mr. Pope and sort of walk around the town with him, which is slowly being rebuilt.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So there were all sorts of, you know, small things like that.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break here. Our guest today is Randall Keenan. We're talking about walking on water. And please stay with us, and we'll be right back to hear some more wonderful stories. Welcome back to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. We're joined today by Randall Keenan, and we're talking about the book Walking on Water. And part of the beauty of the book is the relationship that Mr. Keenan develops with a host of people, a large cast of characters, that welcome him into their communities and share their lives with him. And what was the, were most of the people that you contacted open to the ideas that you were talking about, and how did they take you in?
You know, after all these years, all these states and provinces, because I was in Canada too, I was only turned down once, and I discovered later that the woman was quite ill, and she couldn't do it. But yeah, I was moved, in fact. And I realized, I mean, a number of things. I mean, one of my heroes is a fellow North Carolinian, Joseph Mitchell, who wrote for The New Yorker. And he hits on it there, you know, when he sort of focused on ordinary folk. And I didn't talk to people who were, you know, sort of powerful, you know, magnates or
right.
congressmen in the city. I talked to everyday folk. And you know, I think it was flattering on one level to have somebody, some stranger, come in,
mm-hmm.
sit down, and, you know, tell me about you.
Mm-hmm.
And have patience and be genuinely interested,
mm-hmm.
and that opened a lot of doors, I think, because I didn't come there, I didn't want anything but their words,
right,
in their story.
And it's amazing what happens when you listen to people, isn't it?
Oh gosh, and they were beginning to tell me things, and I'm like, are you sure you want to tell me all this?
Yeah. Maybe told you some things you'd rather not have known.
Now hold on here.
Yeah, so
but no,
maybe a little more information than I needed, but
right.
Yeah, that I think that's one of the interesting parts of the stories is the fact that all of the people are changing in each new venture that you go on, and so you meet a lot of very interesting people. At the end of all of this arduous work that you did, Lord knows how many miles you put on your truck and.
Over 75,000.
Over 75,000.
That was twice across the country.
Wow.
And to Alaska.
Did you get a TV commercial out of that or anything?
I should have thought about it earlier.
You should have, yeah. I should have had your agent working on that.
Yeah.
If you could have got mileage, I mean, just think of that.
There are all sorts of things I could have gotten.
Yeah. when you kind of knew that the journey was over, and I assume you were writing this as you went, when you finally kind of put the last period on the final draft and said, I think this baby is done, it's time to show it to the world. Number one, what was the feeling like when you finally felt that you had finished this labor of love? And number two, what did you take away and what do you think readers will discover when they read Walking on Water?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, it was a huge amount of material to digest and synthesize and come up with some conclusion that wasn't pat, and that was my main worry, mm-hmm. to just sort of like tie it up with some ribbon that didn't fit. And I came away with the primary thing was some workable way to think about black identity, a construct that wasn't contradictory, because being black in America is composed of a political element, it's composed of a cultural element, and then there's an emotional element. I mean, that was the biggest eye opener for me, and it's complicated, but it's visceral and it's real, and it's something I had not valued enough, and there was something, and I talked to a lot of people in there when I walked into, you know, a bar in Idaho, and saw another black person. I mean, there was a sense of connection. It was largely emotional. There was no. No, I don't know that man. I'm not related to that man. I have nothing to do with that man. Right. But we both, you know, if he chose and I chose, would feel the sense of brotherhood. And that is sort of an emotional, but at the same time, real connection. Mm-hmm. So yeah, at the end, I did. I mean, not to mention this huge, you know, sort of treasure trove. And I do think of it as a treasure trove of history.
Yes.
This knowledge of what black people mean to this country and how intricately woven we are into the fabric, and then meeting these people, hearing these stories. But yeah, coming away with some working notion of what it means to be black in America.
Yeah. Yes, I can't speak highly enough of Mr. Keenan's writing, and we haven't had time today to talk about A Visitation of Spirits in detail, which is a novel that Mr. Keenan wrote. And just tell us a bit about that novel. And so for the people that read your stories and then read your opus, Walking on Water, tell us a little bit about A Visitation of Spirits and how that fits into your oeuvre.
Well, it's Looney Tunes. It was the first novel I wrote. It's set in Tim's Creek. And it's a family crisis. It takes place in three different stories being told simultaneously. One about a young man who is sort of losing his mind and is hallucinating and walking through the town in the middle of the night naked, going through his past and being haunted by demons and all sorts of spirits and gobbledies. And a few years later, the two oldest members of his family and a young minister go to visit a dying relative. And that minister is sort of tells the family history. So it's all these stories woven together. And it was the first place I really sort of developed Tim's Creek and started to play with the ideas of the African-American community.
Will we be visiting Tim's Creek again?
Oh, yes. I'm working on a novel, almost done, which it starts in Tim's. Its main heart is in Tim's Creek, but it sort of ranges a bit farther.
Okay, so Tim's Creek and parts adjacent.
Yes, and far-flung.
And far-flung. Good. Do we have a working title yet, or is it...
The Fire and the Baptism.
Oh, I love that title. Any idea of a publication date yet, or...
Next year, I hope.
Next year?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's let our listeners get started with Visitation of Spirits, then Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, and then treat yourself to Walking on Water, Black American Lives at the Turn of the 21st Century, and I assure you that you will enjoy the journey to Tim's Creek and then all over the United States and Alaska, Saskatchewan. And then what I'd like, Randall, is when the novel comes out next year, let's revisit Tim's Creek and talk again, and we'll find out what's going on in your life and the lives of your characters at that point.
It's a date.
You got it.
Thank you so much.
Our guest today has been Randall Keenan, Tune in next week for Casey Coar's A Celebration of Words, and we'll continue our push to be heard in the world of literature.